Pope Francis is recovering from pneumonia at the Vatican, but who's running the show? And the tax-exempt status of Catholic charities is being questioned. Why? Editor of Catholic World News, Philip Lawler, is here with analysis. And tensions between China and Taiwan are on the rise after live fire drills by the CCP took place in Taiwanese waters. President of the Population Research Institute, Stephen Mosher, weighs in. And Washington, D.C. priest Monsignor Charles Pope shares his new book about what he calls the often ignored Catholic doctrine, the hell there is. The world over starts right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you this evening. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo and at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. Pope Francis was discharged from the Gemelli Clinic on March 23rd to continue his recovery at home at the Casa Santa Marta within the Vatican. How is he managing to govern the Church Universal after, by all accounts, a close brush with death? And who in his inner circle is assisting him? Here with analysis of this question and much more, the editor of Catholic World News, Philip Lawler. Phil, thanks for being here. As I mentioned, Pope Francis is continuing his recovery at the Vatican in his apartment. And since then, Vatican business has rolled along with the appointment of a new Archbishop of Omaha and a decree advancing five causes for canonization. In a March 29th interview with an Italian paper, Cardinal Pietro Parolin, the Secretary of State, assures the faithful that even on his worst days, the Pope is still governing the Church. Now, Philip, Parolin also acknowledged that at times Pope Francis has been unable to initial, he can't sign the document, but he just puts his initial, a single F. Your reaction?
Well, the questions that you asked at the top of the program, I don't know the answers to those questions. How is Pope Francis governing the Church? I don't really know. Who's in charge or who are the people closest to him who are making decisions when he can't? I don't know the answers to that. Pope Francis has never been much for delegating authority. He's done things by himself. And now it's very clear he can't do by himself all the things that he was accustomed to doing. So who's doing them for him? Are they not getting done? We really don't know the answers to those questions and probably won't for a little while. It's pretty clear that he is, I don't want to say incapacitated, but he's not able to do nearly the sort of things that he would like to do. Just the other day, the latest bulletin from his doctor said that his lungs are getting better. Well, getting better after more than a month of intense work, that indicates they're still not perfect. He is still very much a patient, requiring 24/7 medical care, unable to talk normally, apparently unable to use his hands normally. So he's very limited in what he's able to do.
Yeah, well, in that interview with Corriere della Sera, Parolin also says that Pope Francis is resting and not receiving visitors or holding meetings, and that no definitive plans have been made for Holy Week, Easter, a big canonization on the 27th. Philip, given the severity of what the Pope went through, double pneumonia, I mean, as you mentioned, it seems obvious that he is somewhat incapacitated and he'll have to delegate those Holy Week and Easter services to a cardinal. But what do you make of the statement that the Pope is not taking guests or meetings?
Well, he's taking some meetings. He's met with Cardinal Parolin. He's met with Archbishop Peñapera, the Sustituto. He is meeting a few of the Vatican officials, apparently Cardinal Fernandez, because Cardinal Fernandez spoke as with authority about the Pope situation. So he's having a few meetings, but he's also spending a lot of time in therapy and a lot of time at rest. So we're entering a period of the pontificate where you do notice a lot of other prelates are sort of flexing their muscles as if this is the time when they can begin doing things that in the past maybe they wouldn't have dared do because the Pope would countermand their actions.
Yeah. What's your take on the Vatican communications during this time? Really, from Francis's illness and hospitalization and now into his recovery, have they been transparent enough for you, clear enough?
Not really, but better than they were in the past. They did let us know that he was seriously ill. They did let us know after the fact that he was close to death, but I think reading between the lines, we knew that at the time. In the past, they've been much worse. You remember with Pope John Paul II, they were loath to admit that he was sick when it was obvious to anyone who saw the man. So they're getting better, but there's still an awful lot we don't know. That reflects the management style of Pope Francis, because he has, as I say, always been wanting to do things himself and to control the narrative himself. Well, he's not in a position to do that now.
I also want to get your take on this quote from Cardinal Parolin from a March 27th event, and I quote, "Perhaps he won't be able to work as before, and in that case, we must find different ways for him to continue leading the church," end quote. Phil, what do you think that means, different ways of leading the church? And what are they, why are they just figuring all of this out on the fly?
In a way, they have to. Pope Francis has no interest in resigning. I don't know that he has to resign. After all, the Pope, there are very few things that the Pope absolutely has to do. You can let the machinery roll on, and every once in a while you come to the Pope to put his initials on a piece of paper. And let's face it, that situation might be very enjoyable for a lot of people around Rome.
Well, Phil, Parolin has weighed in on, this is Cardinal Parolin, the Secretary of State, for those of you just joining us or not quite sure of all the players. Now, he has spoken out just this week on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the Russian-Ukrainian war. He's received the president of Poland. He presided over the 20th anniversary mass of the death of, commemorating the death of St. John Paul II. Is he the vice pope or positioning himself for the next conclave, do you think?
Yes. There's no way around that. Someone has to represent the Vatican in formal international affairs, in church affairs, and it falls to the Secretary of State. So Cardinal Parolin would always have been on the short list of papabili if a conclave were coming, and I think now, unavoidably, he's at the top of that list. That doesn't mean he'll be elected, but he will be the most visible cardinal going into the conclave whenever it happens.
Mm-hmm. I want to show you something. This is an interesting example of a statement, I'll put that in quotes, issued by the Vatican and Pope Francis. It's a produced video of Francis urging the faithful to use technology to unite, not divide. And you can see the images here. The video was released on April 1st. We do not see current images of Pope Francis, and his voice was recorded before he was hospitalized in February. There's a disclaimer at the end which speaks to that. Phil, what do you make of the video and the impression it leaves, particularly given the dire nature of the Pope's health right now?
Good question. I don't think Pope Francis is vain about his appearance. I do think that he is reluctant to let people see just how weak he is. And the one appearance, public appearance he made on Sunday before leaving the hospital was actually sort of shocking. He let's face it, he looked very bad. And his physical condition is obviously weakened. And the doctors have said that the problem that he has with his lungs is not going to go away. So there is a distinct probability that this problem is going to come back again. And I think he's, as I say, reluctant to alarm the faithful and let the people know that his health is really, I won't say in jeopardy, but it's not secure.
Yeah. I want to move on to a perennial problem for the Vatican, the case of disgraced artist and former Jesuit priest Marco Rupnik. The Jesuits announced they're offering reparations to 20 women who've come forward accusing Rupnik of abuse. And this week, the Bishop of Lourdes decided to cover Rupnik's artwork at the French shrine out of respect for the victims. Interestingly, the shrine at Fatima is not considering removing or covering the large Rupnik mosaic in the Basilica of the Holy Trinity, but they have decided to suspend all use of those images containing the artwork. Let's start with what should be done with his art. We'll talk about the case in a moment, but what should be done with the art, Phil, in your estimation?
Well, actually, I think it should all be trashed, but then I thought that long before the scandal erupted around Rupnik. I hate his
Me too.
Work. So yeah. That's, I'm not sure I'm answering your question properly. I think that...
I'll take it, Phil.
The artwork, to me, actually, it sort of matches what one has learned about him. The faces, the elongated faces with the big dark eyes. You know, you see that sort of picture from abuse victims. I can't, now that we know that background, I can't separate the history yeah. from the art. It's not like Caravaggio. This is a different sort of thing.
Well, they're a distorted view of humanity. They're a distorted view of these saintly figures. And you're right. There's those dark, huge eyes. Sometimes they share eyes, which is really creepy. Mm-hmm. From an artistic point of view, we could spend all evening going through the horrors of, I think, his artistic choices, in addition to which it's ugly. The Knights of Columbus in Washington decided to cover up all of his art at the John Paul II Cultural Center, which, if you go in there, they renovated the entire place in Rupnik mosaic. So that's a big job for them. But look, Rupnik was booted by the Jesuits. He's still a priest with faculties. And the cardinal prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, or the Dicastery for the Doctrine of Faith, are still in the process of appointing judges to preside at Rupnik's trial. All they'll say is, we've made a list, we're getting close. Why should a case like this remain unresolved, and why are the gears grinding so slowly, Phil?
There's some element of mystery there, but I have to say the arrows point towards Pope Francis. Of course, Rupnik was excommunicated, and then the excommunication was lifted within less than a month. That could not have been done without at least the tacit approval of the Pope. And of course, that's long before his current illness. The Vatican has stalled on this. Pope Francis did eventually say he wanted a trial after first saying he didn't want a trial of Rupnik. That was 2 years ago. And after two years, what has the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith done? Well, they've made a list of judges. That does not bespeak any urgency. And yet, here's the interesting thing. There does seem to be some action now since the Pope has been ill. And again, I find myself wondering, is that a matter where the Pope's grip on the machinery of the Vatican is weakened and various people are doing what they wanted to do all along? For instance, did the bishop at Lourdes decide to cover up these artworks because he now knows that things are moving in that case at last? I certainly hope so.
Well, Phil, look, it's no secret. Here's what we do know. Rupnik was very close to the Pope. In fact, images by Rupnik still hang in the papal apartment. We've seen them in recent photographs just before his hospitalization. But more importantly, the ubiquity of that art, I'm using the term lightly, you can find it in shrines and churches all over the world. And that's
Absolutely.
All because of his patron, Pope Francis, because Pope Francis and the Vatican sort of gave him the nod. In fact, he's still on the Vatican website. Every holy day, we're punished by these ugly images while
Exactly.
Caravaggio and all these gorgeous works are suppressed. His entire ubiquity is a function of Pope Francis's closeness and the relationship there. So I imagine whatever happens to him will also hinge on that. I'll give you the last word on this.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And I think that Pope Francis now seems to be in a weakened condition. He is not able to attend to details. People who have been delegated the task to try. Father Rupnik realized that they can now go ahead with that trial without worrying too much about repercussions, because Pope Francis won't be in a position to punish them.
I want to move on to the U.S. Supreme Court's consideration of Catholic Charities' tax-exempt status as a religiously based organization. A Wisconsin chapter of Catholic Charities challenged the Wisconsin High Court's assertion that they do not qualify for tax exemption because they are not, quote, operated primarily for religious purposes, end quote. This stems from Wisconsin's refusal to allow Catholic Charities to opt out of paying into the state's unemployment insurance system, which is mandatory. The U.S. Supreme Court seems to be sympathetic so far to Catholic Charities, Phil. And the crux of this case seems to be that Catholic Charities is no different from any other nonprofit. Will that hold up, do you think, in court?
Now, from what I saw of the arguments, the oral arguments before the Supreme Court this past Monday, it certainly seems that a majority of the justices will side with Catholic Charities and say that this is not the business of a secular court to decide whether or not this institution complies with the principles of its own faith. In other words, the courts aren't going to tell us that Catholic Charities is not acting as a Catholic institution. And I think that's appropriate. I don't want secular courts to make that determination. I do think it's a very good question for us as Catholics to ask. Is Catholic Charities acting as a Catholic institution?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a good internal question. I worry about secular authorities and governments making that call. That's a problem. But before we run out of time, and in a somewhat related vein, actually, the University of Notre Dame announced that it will award its prestigious Latare Medal to the president of Catholic Charities USA, Kerry Alice Robinson. And the award will be bestowed at this year's commencement in May, as they often are. The medal honors Robinson explicitly for her individual work and expresses support for the work of Catholic Charities. Interestingly enough, the newly inaugurated sitting president of the United States, Donald Trump, will not be asked to deliver this year's commencement address. I covered this on my podcast this week, Phil, and I did some deep diving into this. Clinton spoke, Bush spoke, Obama spoke, and Biden got the Latare Medal despite his support for abortion. Your thoughts on all of this?
I think it's deliberate. There are two deliberate decisions there, very obviously. One, not inviting Trump to speak. Although, as you point out, the university has typically given an invitation to a newly inaugurated sitting president to come speak. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. But then, choosing Kerry Robinson in her capacity as head of Catholic Charities USA. Catholic Charities USA is right now involved in a political tug of war with the Trump administration. And she, in her statement thanking Notre Dame for the for awarding her the Latare Medal, explicitly said that she was accepting it on behalf of all the employees of Catholic Charities USA. Well, a lot of those employees look likely to be laid off because of decisions made by the Trump administration. So you have a pretty clear setup there. Notre Dame is letting us know which side they're on.
Yeah, that's unfortunate because it's an, you know, you have this incredible Catholic institution, such a legacy. And, you know, if free inquiry and academic pursuits and engaging the culture, which is what Hesburgh said when he, you know, started this Latare Medal and all of this, if that's the goal, why not invite everybody into the, under the dome? Why restrict it to only certain political parties? I think it makes Notre Dame look horrible. And I don't know why they're engaging in this. They stood firm when Marianne Glendon turned down the Latare Medal because she felt they were honoring a president in Obama who was so opposed to Catholic teaching on so many levels, she couldn't accept the medal beside him. Now you have a situation where you're not even inviting the sitting president. I'll give you the last word.
Exactly right. It's a partisan sort of thing, and it's explicitly partisan. And if they had given Robinson the Latare Medal and invited Trump or done neither, it would not be so blatantly political. But to do to honor someone who is currently in a Tong war with the president while conspicuously failing to invite the president, that puts Notre Dame in the position of playing politics, which is just unseemly for an institution of that prestige.
Philip Lawler, we will leave it there, and you can see all of Philip's reporting and commentary at catholicculture.org. Thank you, Phil.
Thank you.
This week on the Arroyo Grande podcast, I sat down with an incredible six-year-old who is the honorary mascot of the Dallas Mavericks, Cash Bubba Harris. He lives with spina bifida, and he and his dad, Chase Harris, who's a physical therapist, together have waged a battle against this disease with discipline, joy, faith, and the love that can only be shared between a father and a son. Take a look. What do you think about that? Do you like the therapy sessions, or are they hard?
I like them.
You do? Why?
I like them because Papa makes them fun. He makes them fun, and he challenges me a lot.
Well, that's why you're running like a crazy man now, and making us all run out of breath watching you go to the Mavericks game and travel, and you're here and you're there and you're posting. You're more engaged than there's a lot of able-bodied kids I know that are far less engaged in their lives than you are. Is that part of the lesson?
It is.
To keep everybody engaged.
It is. And just to explain, you don't have to not live your life, regardless of your circumstance. And so the poor pitiful me is something that I do not allow for him, because just as you said, there's able-bodied kids that don't get to live his life.
Yeah.
And so for us to take a sense of arrogance or lack of gratitude because he uses this, I mean, that wouldn't make sense to me.
What do you want people to know about adversity and when you face it and deal with it?
The biggest thing about adversity is the battle in your mind. We're always going to have it. It's never going to go away. But it's how you approach it. Are you going to approach it knowing that there's something better on the other side?
That is so true.
Or are you going to allow it to take you where it wants to take you?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I love that you've not only made the best of it, you together are creating lives that most people don't get to live. And you know what I love most of all, and I do want you to talk about this, both of you, the importance of a father to a son, because we often degrade fathers. I had a parenting expert, Dr. Meeker, on recently, and she talked about how men are devalued in the culture. Mm-hmm. They make fun of them on TV. They're always a goofy dad. Look at a goofball over there. Mm-hmm. Your dad is everything but goofy.
He's not goofy.
He's not goofy. These are such incredible people. And look, this is an inspiring episode for anybody battling infirmity, or if you're just looking for inspiration. The Harrises or something. The full Arroyo Grande interview with Cash and Chase Harris is now on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show or wherever you get your podcasts. And I sound off on the White House correspondents firing a barely known comic, the hidden story of a household staple, and much more. Check it out and subscribe so you don't miss an Arroyo Grande episode. The links are all at RaymondArroyo.com. China is once again this week provoking Taiwan and threatening the island nation. With analysis is president of the Population Research Institute and author of The Devil and Communist China, Stephen Mosier. Steve, thanks for being here. With all the political noise in D.C. and talks about tariffs, et cetera, which I'll get to, China is all but being ignored. Just this week, the communist government launched live-fire military drills around Taiwan. This is clearly a warning against Taiwan's independence. How much longer can Taiwan remain independent and withstand this creeping pressure from Beijing, Steve?
Well, Raymond, the key time frame, I think, is this year, because Taiwan is building up its military defenses. China is not quite ready for an invasion. We can talk about why not. But it did just this week conduct a blockade-style exercise around the island. And you had airplanes and ships all around the island blocking or practicing a blockade of Taiwan's major ports, which would, in the event of an actual blockade, cut the island off from trade, cut the island off from from sources of oil and natural gas. And the island would be, I think, in trouble after a few weeks as it ran short of energy. So I'm very worried about a blockade. An invasion, Xi Jinping, China's dictator, has said, we want to take Taiwan back by 2027. That's only 2 years away now. And I know they are frantically now building invasion barges. I don't.
Yeah, I was
going to
talk about that. That story. The New York Times had that story this week where they have these. Explain to people what these are. These are basically floating bridges. Explain to them, Steve, what this is and what it means.
They are. People may remember World War II landing craft, okay? These are giant versions of the same, except instead of an offloading ramp, they have a huge extendable bridge-like structure for offloading. So you can sit 100 yards offshore, you can extend this huge ramp, and then you can get your tanks and your armored personnel carriers and your self-propelled artillery off the ship and onto the ground for an invasion. Now, they're building lots of these things, and the only possible use for these invasion barges is invading Taiwan. They're not useful for transporting cargo. They're not useful for transporting oil or anything else. So clearly, they're building up a fleet of these things for the purpose of an invasion. They're not done yet. Taiwan is a tough nut to crack because the west coast of the island is all mudflats extending out for about a mile into the ocean. You can't land on those. The east coast is all rocky cliffs and rocky shores. Hard to land on those. That's why they're building these invasion barges. I am quite frankly worried about a blockade right now, because they could try to cut off the island from commerce with the rest of the world, which would hurt not only Taiwan, but the United States and other countries that do trade with Taiwan. And I was very, very pleased to see, for the first time in the last 5 years, that we issued a strong statement, the State Department did, in defense of Taiwan. We said that China was engaging in intimidation tactics and destabilizing behavior, and the U.S.'s enduring commitment to our allies and partner, including Taiwan, continues. Now, that's a stern warning to Beijing to keep their hands off Taiwan. They have virtually declared war against the elected president of Taiwan, President Lai, who basically has said that that China is a hostile foreign power. Well, it is. And it's behaved with hostility towards not just Taiwan, but toward a lot of its neighbors, Japan, the Philippines, and of course, towards the United States of America.
You know, I hate these suppositions, but I'm going to throw one out anyway, hypotheticals.
Okay.
What if they end up invading Taiwan? What do you think the United States' reaction would be, given what we're seeing in Ukraine?
Well, the reason that we have ongoing conflicts in the Middle East and ongoing conflicts in Ukraine, first of all, is because of China's support of those incursions by Putin against Ukraine and support of Iran and, by extension, Hamas in the Middle East. So this is an effort at one level by China to disperse our forces and deplete our munitions. Now, sad to say, given the state of our supply chains, which in part are dependent upon China, that has been successful. We have a lot of assets now in the Middle East. We have far fewer than we would need in the Far East to help with the defense of Taiwan. The good news is that Japan is restructuring its military command structure and moving forces south towards the islands, which are very close to Taiwan, the southern islands of Japan. The Philippines has said that any conflict over Taiwan would necessarily involve it. So the other countries in Asia are actually stepping up and saying, you know, it's really not good for us for China to invade and take over Taiwan, because that will threaten our security. And I think that sort of joint response, that sort of joining together with other countries and forming a pseudo alliance against Chinese aggression is probably the best way to deter it.
China said on Thursday that it will firmly oppose those U.S. tariffs on its exports, saying U.S. tariffs are in violation of international trade rules. President Trump imposed a 10% tariff on imports from all over the world, 34% tariffs aimed at China, in addition to the 10% base tariff. Beijing is calling for dialogue, Steve. How much damage is being done to China's economy, if any? And your thoughts on the impact of this and what you think the response will be from China?
Well, the base tariff on China is actually more than 10%. It's 20% plus the 34%. Mm-hmm. They're going to have a tariff of 54% on all the goods that they ship to the United States. And the exemption for the all these little packages that come from China that worth $300, $400 is gone now. So all these small postal shipments, they have to pay tariff on those too. Now, I think the Chinese exporters are going to have to actually eat most of the tariffs in order to try to protect their market share in the United States. So I don't expect a great impact on consumers in the United States. And I find it, quite frankly, completely ridiculous that we have papers like the New York Times declaring the trade war begins. My goodness, Raymond, the trade war began decades ago when China, when all those other nations, including China, first and foremost, put tariffs on American goods and drove American companies out of business and drove their workers to the unemployment lines. And we did nothing. You know, China has been cheating on trade for decades, buying off our politicians, duping Wall Street into investing in China rather than the United States. You know, it's almost as if we had a kick me sign on our backside and China was more than happy to oblige. But I'm happy that the gravy train is over for Chinese communist elites who've gotten wealthy off of cheating on trade with the United States. I think their days of ripping off America, breaking the backs of hardworking Americans and looting us of our industries and hollowing out our heartland are over. And I think these tariffs will help to level the playing field. Now, they're still not as they're still not even at 54%. China is still cheating us more than those tariffs will offer a corrective for. Okay?
Right. They so don't we offset have... the amount of the American tariffs, which are much higher. I mean, we've got hundreds of billions of dollars. We're you know, at a trade imbalance with these countries, including China.
Yeah, and it's unsustainable. People need to realize that, yeah, there may be some short-term pain, but there will be huge long-term gain. We cannot sustain this continual hollowing out of our manufacturing base. You know, this lack of domestic manufacturing capacity. In COVID, we were dependent upon pharmaceuticals from where? From China, the same country that actually spread COVID around the world. That's the height of foolishness. And of course, we now have military equipment that is in part dependent upon electronic components from where? From China. That also is the height of foolishness. So I think this is a necessary corrective. Most of the countries, including China, will soon be at the negotiating table, and we will have, for the first time, fair trade. There's no such thing as free trade in the world today. There's free trade within the borders of the United States. But when you go outside those borders, you find countries all over the world keeping our goods out one way or another, like China does, and exporting as much as they can to the United States, the biggest consumer market in the world. And quite frankly, they need us a lot more than we need them. And finally, we have a president who's standing up for the American middle class and American workers, and I applaud.
In the Panama Canal zone, China is holding up a $23 billion sale of dozens of ports all over the world. But those two of special significance are at either end of the Panama Canal. A Chinese conglomerate had said they were going to sell to a U.S. group led by BlackRock after President Trump voiced his concerns about Beijing's outsized influence in the entire Panama Canal zone. Steve, were you surprised that the Chinese group was even prepared to sell to that U.S.-based investment crowd?
Well, I was in a way, Raymond, because in 1996, when Hutchinson Whampoa, run by the wealthiest man in Hong Kong, Li Ka-shing, when they decided to buy the ports at either end of the Panama Canal. That was before Hong Kong reverted to China's control the year after. And after that, you know, we all began to realize, well, I was opposed to giving the canal away to begin with. But we all realized after that that the Panama Canal was now effectively in control of a Chinese-owned company that was under the control of the Chinese Communist Party's leaders in Beijing. Now, when President Trump first talked about recovering the canal, in one way or another, at least control of it and cure it, in ensuring the security for safe passage of American naval vessels, for example, back and forth, ensuring that it would remain open in the event of conflict in Asia or around the world. When he first said that, China said, well, we have no control over the canal. This is a private company, Hutchinson Whampoa, in Hong Kong, and they're running it entirely without our interference, and we have nothing to do with it. Well, as soon as Hutchinson Whampoa decided to sell it to a U.S. company, what happened? Oh, we can't allow that. So this is a tacit admission that China was interested in the security, securing control over the Panama Canal from the beginning, for the same reason that it opened up a naval base in Djibouti, which controls access to the Red Sea and indirectly to the Suez Canal, for the same reason that it set up a naval base in Cambodia, which is close to the Straits of Malacca, another maritime choke point that you would want to choke off in the event of conflict if you were in China, if you were China, to prevent U.S. naval vessels from participating in the war. So this is part of a global strategy on the part of China. Mm-hmm. I hope that we can force the sale through, but right now they're investigating the wealthiest man in Hong Kong for possible violations of security laws. How do you think that's going to wind up?
Yeah, the same way our Jimmy Lai, who we'll talk about in a moment, also ended up. See, before we run out of time, I want to get your take on the ongoing problems of religious freedom in communist China. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom just released its annual report covering 2024. They say this, religious freedom conditions in China remained among the worst in the world. Chinese Communist Party leader Xi Jinping continued to lead efforts to update and enforce China's sinicization of religion policy, which requires the complete loyalty and subordination of recognized religious groups to the CCP, its political ideology, and its policy agenda. Steve, China is still considered a country of particular concern when it comes to religious freedom, but it doesn't seem there are any consequences for that designation.
Well, there should be, because China is persecuting Catholics. It's persecuting Christians of all kinds. It's persecuting Tibetan Buddhists. It's persecuting Uyghur Muslims in the far west. It's persecuting the Mongolians. And basically because the governing ideology of China is communism. That is a cult with its own idea of establishing heaven on earth, with its own church, which is basically the patriotic church of China that everyone has to worship in. It has its own quote-unquote pope, who is Xi Jinping, the supreme leader, who expects to be virtually worshipped by the people. He has a thriving personality cult. So the persecution of Catholics in China continues, and we need to speak out even more strongly about it. I am hopeful that with Marco Rubio as Secretary of State, and I know Senator Rubio, he has been on China's case in terms of human rights for a long, long time. And I believe we will see in the coming months, we will see sterner measures taken towards those officials who persecute Catholics and Christians and other religions in China.
Well, speaking of persecution, Congressman Chris Smith of New Jersey has sponsored a bill seeking to rename a stretch of road near DuPont Circle Jimmy Lai Way in D.C., to honor the incarcerated Chinese dissident, Catholic freedom fighter. The street, interestingly, Steve, runs alongside the Hong Kong Economic and Trade Office. Jimmy Lai is, of course, 77 years old, in very poor health. He's in solitary confinement. He's been there for more than 1,500 days. And as we mentioned a little earlier, he's being tried under this national security law, which is their favorite law to throw down, to basically imprison people they disagree with or want to control. A few weeks ago, Lai's son, Sebastian, was in the U.S. He claims Jimmy could die in prison. Your thoughts on his condition, and does something as, I guess, minuscule as renaming a street, might that change the math here at all or move the needle of his case?
Well, there's a lot we can do. But first of all, back to Jimmy Lai and his personal situation. Yes, he's being held in solitary confinement. The trial is going on and on and on. In this case, we say, Raymond, the process is a punishment. They're just dragging this out as long as possible so they can keep him in solitary confinement, keep him away from contact with his family and other supporters. What the United States ought to do is I think that Congressman Chris Smith's move is long overdue, but I would go further. I would shut down the Hong Kong office in Washington, D.C. Hong Kong is now a part of China. It does not deserve a separate consulate in the United States. We should stop with the pretense that Hong Kong is somehow, one country, two systems. It's not a separate system. It's under the direct control of the Chinese Communist Party. Let's acknowledge that fact. And while we're shutting down that office, let's shut down the other dozen secret police stations in American cities like Minneapolis, St. Paul, and other cities. We did that in New York City. We've got to do it in other cities. Shut down these undercover operatives who try to persecute dissidents, Chinese dissidents in the United States on our own sovereign territory, and of course try to wine and dine American local politicians to gain power and influence. And let's reduce the staff of the consulates and the embassy of the People's Republic of China to the same number as the number of staffers we have in China. Let's have strict reciprocity there. If we have 120 people in China representing the U.S., they should only have 120 people here. Right now, they have thousands, Raymond.
Wow. Yeah, that should definitely be abridged. And again, reciprocity is a good thing. Steve, we'll leave it there. The Devil and Communist China, From Mao Down to Xi, by Stephen Mosier, is available at bookstores everywhere. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
The existence of hell is one of the central dogmas of the Catholic Church, yet many Catholics question its existence, and priests even tend to avoid it in Sunday homilies. My next guest has written a new book reminding us why hell plays a key role in God's plan of salvation. He's a parish priest of the Archdiocese of Washington and author of the new book, The Hell There Is, an exploration of an often rejected doctrine of the Church, published by Tan Books. Please welcome back to the program Monsignor Charles Pope. Monsignor, thank you for joining us. You say that of all the theological heresies out there, this one really is the granddaddy. And you write this, even among the more devout, such as those who go to daily mass, the teaching that God would send or consign anyone to hell is routinely dismissed. Why do you think, Monsignor, Catholics have learned to essentially deny this doctrine?
Well, I think the primary issue is more sociological. There have been some theological, modernism likes to push, the kind of theoretically medieval notions of the church back to the background and kind of put on more of a happy face. But I still think that's reflecting a cultural trend where I think we've reduced love to mere kindness. Of course, kindness is an aspect of love, but so is correction. So is respect for one's freedom. You can't force someone to love you. And that's why there's a hell. It's not about an angry God trying to keep people out of heaven, but rather a deeply loving God who is very reverential of our freedom. And he stands at the door and knocks. He doesn't barge in. And we have to recover a sense that we have a decision to make, whether we really want to be with God in heaven one day, the real heaven, not a made up one. And so that's why I wrote the book. I wanted to recast the teaching to get rid of this notion that somehow we're saying there's a mean, angry God who just doesn't like people and wants to keep them out.
And Monsignor, it's a physical place. Is hell a physical place? Or is it just the absence of God?
It's both. It is physical in the sense that we have bodies, or we will certainly at the great second coming, our bodies will be restored. So since bodies occupy space, then hell is certainly a place. It's not just a mentality or something,
Monsignor, Pope Francis, when asked about hell by an Italian TV presenter in early 2024, said the following: "What I am going to say is not a dogma of faith, but my own personal view. I like to think of hell as empty. I hope it is." Monsignor Pope, I know Pope Francis wasn't speaking dogmatically or authoritatively here even, but when the Pope speaks, how many do you think take those musings seriously, and your thoughts on this idea of hell being empty?
Yeah, well, again, I think that it's unfortunate when even when they're clear, they're just expressing an opinion. I think popes need to be very careful about what they say, because it carries authority whether they want to admit it or not. Now, that said, I would rather just go with Jesus' clear answer to the question. When directly asked the question, are those who are to be saved few or many? He said, few. And I know he said that with sadness. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But again, it's in both Matthew and in Luke. But the Lord says, look, the answer to your question is, sadly, the road to damnation is wide and many follow it. The road to salvation is narrow and difficult. And how few there are who find it. It's the way of the cross. And people don't like crosses. They don't like suffering. Now, one other quick way of putting it is Jesus said, here's the nature of the judgment, that the light has come into the world, but many prefer the darkness.
Yeah. We've heard Pope Francis speak clearly about the existence of hell and the devil himself at times. So what are the effects, do you think, of the mixed messaging? I mean, when you have a pope saying, well, I hope hell is empty and there's nothing there. On the other hand, hell is a reality and you're going to go there. I mean, what message does that send to the casual viewer, never mind the attentive Catholic?
Well, that we shouldn't really take the Lord that seriously, it would seem to imply. In other words, I think nobody loves you and me more than Jesus, and yet nobody spoke of hell more than Jesus. Most of the statements about hell in the Bible come right out of the mouth of Jesus. 21 of the 38 parables are devoted to this topic. There's the wise versions, the foolish versions, the sheep, the goats, those on the right, those on the left, the wheat, the tares. I could go on, but parable after parable, teaching after teaching, Jesus warns that many are on the wrong path, and we've got to stop and make a decision and be more urgent about this thing in our life. And if I can say one thing about the church today, we don't have any sense of urgency. Everyone's the deal is done. Who needs to be saved? It's already taken care of. And that's not true.
Well, Monsignor, I always say they got out of the salvation business somewhere along the way, and we got into, you know, other things, social justice and immigration and making people feel good and synodal talking. But the focus on salvation somehow got lost in the shuffle or muted. You write about sins against the Holy Spirit in your book. St. Thomas Aquinas named six of these, despair, presumption, impugning truth, envy of others, spiritual good, obstinacy in sin, and final impenitence. Monsignor, we've always been told that God forgives, the Lord's mercy is infinite. Rarely do we hear about one unforgivable sin against the Holy Spirit. Can you explain this concept and how it can consign a soul to hell in Catholic traditional teaching and thought?
Well, as you've mentioned, there are a number of different things that Thomas distinguishes, but really at the heart of it, and it's the main reason I'm so worried today about a lot of people, which is I'm not so concerned about people who know how to come to confession. They're struggling. They have habitual sins of some sort. This is very common in the human family, but they know it's wrong, and they go to God and they say, I'm sorry, I need help. And that's beautiful in its own way, you know, and God wants to help and we'll free them. But the ones I'm worried about are the defiant, who shake their fist against the church and the teachings of Scripture and say, look, I will not be told what to do. I'm going to celebrate my lifestyle, celebrate my abortion, celebrate, you know, a lifestyle that God calls an abomination, whatever, or celebrate greed or violence. And I don't think there's anything wrong. I don't need forgiveness. And that's an unforgivable sin, because you can't impose mercy or forgiveness. You know, if I were to say to you, hey, Raymond, I forgive you for all the terrible things you said about me yesterday, you would say, well, wait a minute. I think I needed to say those things and you should have heard them. I can't impose forgiveness or mercy on you or anyone else. And God's not doing that either. He's saying, look, I offer you my mercy, but you have to admit you need it and unlock the door of repentance mercy with your repentance. But too many people today, nope, nothing wrong with what I'm doing.
You write at length about Dante's vision of hell, and you state that it's not entirely original. Dante based a lot of his ideas on ancient sources. Virgil, who leads Dante on his tour of hell, reminds the Italian poet of Aristotle's Ethics, where hell was divided into three major categories: incontinence, vice, and brute bestiality. Dante adapts them rather in his epic poem. What do we have to learn from Dante's vision of hell? And why has that vision defined what so many of us imagine as hell?
You know, Dante obviously is not a theologian. He was not a church father. He's certainly not a book of scripture. But Dante was, first of all, very influenced by the church, but then also he had his own way of influencing. And I think one of the greatest contributions he made is something that St. Thomas Aquinas also taught, namely that in hell, there's probably not everybody suffers in the same way. That there, pardon the expression, but the crime, the punishment befits the crime. And that if a person clung to certain sinful habits or patterns, those will be the things that, okay, God says, if you want to have it, it's all yours. You can have it in abundance. And this is kind of the way this actually leads to the sufferings of hell. So whether it was lust or gluttony or wrath or anger or hatred or heresy or whatever, you know, the Lord's going to sort of say, okay, if that's what you want, you can have it. I can't force you to love what I love or who I love or agree with me. So if you want to just be on your own with your own approach, it's all yours. And that's the way he sort of envisions hell, like Thomas does, which is that it's a very sad place, but it's a place sort of our own making. It isn't something that, you know, just God, one size fits all punishment.
Yeah, you know, Mother Angelica used to say, Monsignor, that we make our hell here on earth. You know, this is sort of the precursor, and then it just deepens and gets worse. But that speaks to free will. You know, and many would say that it's the freedom to do whatever one wishes. The church teaches that free will is that freedom, that it's a right. But what is truly meant by the freedom of will and God giving us free will?
You know, there's a very interesting way to answer that question. It's right out of the catechism. It says that freedom is the capacity to obey God. I love that. To use the word obedience in the very word that defines freedom, because the truest freedom is obedience to the will of God. There's nothing freer on earth. There's no place freer than inside the commandments. There's no place more glorious than inside God's will, you know? And so again, freedom then is the capacity for us to obey him. Now that said, freedom also does involve a choice. There are just going to be some people who don't want what God is offering. I'll just show it to you. I mean, God's kingdom is about things like chastity. It's about love of one's enemy, forgiveness. It's about liturgy. There's a lot of people that don't want some or all those things on that list. Chastity, please, you know, forgive my enemy. I want to kill my enemy. I mean, and again, greed is prefer. You know, people prefer the darkness. And so their freedom is understood as a capacity to obey God, but it is also understood as an ability to choose for or against what God is offering. And that's why there's a hell. It isn't some mean God. It's a respectful God, respectful of our freedom. And he says, it's really your choice. Please. It's like the father pleading for the second son to come into the feast. You know, the first son's in there. He's back. But the other son, the prodigal son parable, you know, he won't come in. Not on your turn. Nope. It's not heaven for me. Yeah. Don't want to go into that beast. Yeah, don't be that guy.
Monsignor, before I let you go, why did you write this now? I mean, Easter time, Lent, the Lenten season is really a moment when people focus and contemplate those last things, salvation, where your spiritual health is. Why did you write this book now? And what do you want readers to take away from the hell there is?
The two main reasons I wrote this book was that, first of all, I mean, I certainly wanted to, I think, dispel notions about hell that are inaccurate, that there's a mean, angry God who's throwing people into hell. That's wrong. But secondly, I'm very concerned that there's absolutely no urgency today in the church. Who needs sacraments? Only 17% of people go to Mass. Who needs to pray? Who needs to study scripture? Who needs any of this stuff? You know, it's all going to be fine in the end. So there's no urgency, not just among the faithful or the people in general, but among the clergy and bishops. We're all distracted by minor worldly things and souls are being lost. And it's like we need to make everybody feel nice and feel included, but what if they're going to hell? I mean, there's no sense to this anymore. And a second reason is that there's also no joy. If you don't know the bad news, the good news is no news. And I mean, think how glorious our salvation is. I mean, to stand before a crucifix and say, I can't believe that you love me and you forgive me. Thank you, because I know I needed it, you know, but this is all dismissed today. And therefore, not only is there no fear, if you will, but there's also no joy. It's just blah.
Well, there's no battle. Yeah, there's no battle on. Everybody's just coasting in the middle. And that's frankly why it's all, and that all goes downhill. But Monsignor, thank you so much for the time. The Hell There Is, an exploration of the often rejected doctrine of the church by Monsignor Charles Pope, is available in bookstores now and at EWTN's religious catalog. Thank you, Monsignor.
Been an honor. Thank you.
That is all the time we have for now, but be sure to catch us next week. My full interview with comedian and author Joe Piscopo awaits you. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.